Hi, I'm Michael Lehman, the director of this film, and I'll be talking to you very casually while we watch this movie together. And if you think that I'm going to hit you with all the trash about this movie, you'll have to wait for the microchip version that's coming out in the next century, when everybody else is dead. The introductory narration here is by the actor William Conrad, who you may know from Jake and the Fat Man. You may not know was also the voice on the Bullwinkle narration, which is why we hired him. We felt that it was nice to give an introduction to the movie that was a little bit of a wink and an indication that there was going to be a somewhat cartoonish sensibility in some of the violence and some of the action and some of the humor. So we sought out the person who was the Bullwinkle narrator and found that he was an actor that we all knew pretty well, William Conrad. That giant foot there was a prop from Cinecittà, the studio in Rome, and it was left over from some old gladiator movie that had been done in the 50s. Now, that castle there is the castle of San Leo near Rimini in northern Italy. There's our friend Leonardo da Vinci, an Italian actor named Stefano Molinari, who we were told by our Italian casting people was the best Leonardo look-alike in all of Italy who could act. I took their word for it. This sequence, which is a Renaissance gold-making machine in Leonardo's workshop, was actually shot on the stages in Budapest, Hungary, where we constructed some but not all of our interiors. I want to talk here about the cast of the movie. You saw Bruce Willis's name. This movie was a dear project for Bruce Willis, who created the character of Hudson Hawk and developed this over the years and saw the movie, I believe, and I don't want to speak for him, as a favorite personal project that he had a lot invested in. And by the time we ended up making it, it had gone through many, many drafts and a lot of different versions, but Bruce gets a story credit as one of the originators of the story, and also an executive producer credit. The effect you're looking at here was created in post-production after we shot by technicians at Industrial Light and Magic, George Lucas's special effects facility. That reflection as well. But we did build this big machine, and most of the effects in this are created on the set. There's no digital enhancement because this movie was made really before those kind of digital enhancements were even being done. You see the name Sandra Bernhard. She, I think, is an interesting addition to our cast, a very funny woman. Known at the time for having been in Martin Scorsese's movie The King of Comedy, and also known for doing her live performances. But she was not at that point an especially well-known actress, and it was considered a sort of a bold move for us to cast her in the film. And David Caruso, who many of you may know from his television and film work, was at that time a very highly regarded kind of character actor in New York, and we had seen his work, and I thought he was a terrific actor, and this movie was a departure for him. He hadn't played really, I don't think he'd played in a kind of mainstream, bigger-budget commercial movie at all. James Coburn, who is one of my favorites in this film and one of my favorite actors altogether, has a special place in this movie because a lot of the humor and a lot of the attitude in it is reminiscent of or reflective of or was influenced by the humor in movies that Coburn did in the 60s, The President's Analyst and Our Man Flint. So it was something that we were really happy to get him in the movie, and he did a terrific job. Wonderful to work with. I'm going to give you a little tidbit of information here. The mustache and beard that are on Leonardo's face are different than the mustache and beard you're going to see when he steps outside. There you go. Can't get jokes like that anymore, can you? his beard and mustache were lost in transit from Italy to Hungary. And so here he has the right beard and mustache. It was very funny because we actually held up production for a couple of hours when we were shooting the Gold Machine interior because we didn't have his beard and we had to create a new one. And his beard was on a truck that was being held at the border between Italy and Yugoslavia. Here we are once again at the castle in San Leo. And we constructed this flying machine, which is not an actual flying machine. That is a model and a composite shot. That is the model flying. We constructed a full-size version of this and created the effect of flying, I think reasonably well, given the fact that the technology at that point was not as far along as it is now. This movie, by the way, was one of the first movies to use digital effects to remove wires for flying objects. It may actually be the first movie that used that effect. I remember at the time, that's just the dissolve from the flying machine to the bird. I remember at the time being told that we could suspend things from wires and they could go in and digitally remove the wires. And I said, well, how do you do that? And our special effects supervisor, John Knoll at ILM, said, well, you go in and digitize each frame and remove the wires. It's a fairly simple process. And what I didn't realize is that John, who had gone to film school with me at USC, was actually one of the inventors of the Adobe Photoshop program. So he's doing pretty well these days. Here we have Bruce. The exterior shots were actually Sing Sing Prison, which we shot, and we were planning on shooting interiors in Sing Sing, but couldn't really get access to do what we wanted. This interior was shot in L.A. Towards the end of our shoot. You can see how tired Bruce looks because we've been shooting for almost 100 days at that point, which was a good attitude to have being let out of jail. The actor playing Gates is Bert Harris, who's a wonderful New York actor and also a producer, and was for many years Sidney Lumet's first assistant director and producer, and a character. Did a great job. Fun to work with.
We're not yet, wise guy. See, I can set you up and send you back anytime I want. It's a very fine line between ex-con and escape con. Hey, Gates, do it yourself.
So that's the first example of how the Hudson Hawk character, Master Cat Burglar, can remove keys from a guard's hands and lock him in jail. One sweet move. This was our first day of shooting, actually at Sing Sing. That's the gate at Sing Sing. I remember this shot coming up here. It was the very first one we shot, where he walks along. You can see the fold in the hat, vaguely Three Stooges-esque, which was one of the influences for the sillier humor in this story.
The first thing I did, smooch the ground and taste the freedom. Sorry I'm late. Eddie,
Danny Aiello, who plays Tommy, is a great New York actor, was somebody that was discussed for this part even before I got involved. I remember the first time I met with Joel Silver, the producer, and with Bruce Willis. We talked about casting for the film, and Bruce said that he wanted his old friend Danny to play this part, and I was delighted. I was a big fan of Danny's. I thought that was a great move. We talked to a couple other actors, but Danny seemed like the right guy, and all the writing was done with him in mind from that point on. Here we're driving along New Jersey Shore. Now, there's an interesting thing here. This movie, and you'll notice this as you watch it, we play around with continuity with the sequence of events in a way that's not typical. We break things, we break rules all the time, on purpose. And when the movie came out, one of the many reasons why it was criticized is that people said that, well, you know, they break all these rules. Well, we were doing that because we were having fun with this style of movie. We thought it was time to take the action-adventure comedy genre and turn it around a bit. So what I was going to mention here is that behind Bruce and behind Danny, both sides, is the New York skyline. So in real life, you don't have any spot where you have the west side of New York on both sides of your car, but it exists in this movie for the rest of eternity. Here we are in Hoboken.
house. What are you
doing? He's
your
parole officer, for Christ's sake.
He's my parole officer.
Look, I am not going deaf.
Tommy, what?
Just get me in a five tone.
Yeah, all right.
The five tone is the bar that Danny's character owned, and Bruce's character, Hudson Hawk, had been in jail for many years. This shot started on a crane. The Steadicam came down, but we cut it up into pieces. It was one of those attempts to do a nice long shot that got butchered in the cutting room. See, here's some humor that definitely dates the movie. He's talking about yuppies. Remember them? Everybody talked about yuppies back then in the late 1980s. And one of the strains of humor in this movie had to do with the financial excesses of the 1980s and the Reagan era, and you'll see that in the bad guys and the way things are depicted. I think most of that survived the film. We had a few more jokes like that in here. Here Hudson Hawk is trying to drink a cappuccino. And you may not realize that back then, in the old days, there was not a cappuccino bar on every corner in this country. And we were actually concerned that people wouldn't know what a cappuccino was. And there was some talk up front about whether we should have him drink something else. The two guys who just shot at him there, the Mario Brothers, as they were called. The one on the right is Frank Stallone, who is Sly Stallone's brother, and an actor and a singer, and a funny guy. The one on the left is Carmine Zozzoro, who was the one in the middle there. Carmine was involved in the production, also a funny guy, a New Jersey character.
Directions even your brother could understand.
Yeah, directions even I could understand.
Shut up. Hawk, you're the best. You're the only one who can do this job, you know that. Don't tell me a lot of horse shit. You want to open up a hardware store, go straight and sell spatulas.
I always love the way Frank Stallone says the word spatula. Sounds like spatulets. For a long time, we sat in the cutting room saying, are people going to think this is spatulets?
Sid, have you lovely ladies tried our house wine? I think you'll enjoy.
Feed it, Tommy, huh? No dinosaurs allowed.
Enough!
You don't do that. Now, the thing is, when this movie came out, a lot of people, I think, were expecting a solid, hard action movie along the lines of Die Hard or Die Hard 2. And we were attempting to provide a little bit of action and a lot of the kind of pyrotechnics you see in those movies. But this was and was meant to be a comedy. You can see in the background on the TV there are hyenas eating some carrion. We thought that was a good yuppie detail in a bar.
Witchcraft. 3 minutes, 57 seconds.
Night and day.
So a running theme in the movie is that Bruce and Danny's characters use the timing of songs to time their robberies. And this was an idea that Daniel Waters, the screenwriter, came up with. I thought it was a terrific idea. The thought that two guys who were great burglars and a great team used completely low-tech methods, and that rather than have complicated timing devices or any sort of high-tech tools, Hudson Hawk used lockpicks. He never used a gun. This was part of the original conception that Bruce had for the character and that Steve D'Souza, who wrote the first draft of this form of the script, did. The idea was that Hudson Hawk and Tommy had their own sort of very personal method of timing out their burglaries, and they played this game of timing songs together. It seemed like a really great idea when it was come up with, and there was a lot of discussion between me and Dan and Joel Silver and Bruce Willis about what kind of songs to use, because we were wide open. We finally decided to settle on certain kind of show tunes. There are two places where they sing songs while they burglarize, and I thought that was a good choice, and I think it lends a proper sense of humor to those scenes. But, well, when we get to them, I'll talk about it more. But that was something that also was pretty, raised a lot of eyebrows around when the movie came out. This scene, by the way, was shot in Rome, where we built actually most of our sets, if not the biggest sets.
How many seconds?
How many what seconds?
On the thumb cuffs.
Well, not counting the bitching and whining, I'll be nice and say eight. You know they're not going to let you walk away from this job, kiddo.
I ain't never going to get rehabilitated this way, Tommy.
See, we were trying to inject a little reality in it here, that Hudson Hawk didn't want to be a criminal anymore. This was part of the original scheme here. Now we're back in New York. We are on 57th Street, and shooting at the location at night. Real pain in the ass to shoot in New York at night. Wonderful place to shoot, though. And this must have been the first week of shooting. We were already running across difficulties getting everything done because it was a complicated shoot. Same location, same building. You can see there's no traffic on the street. That's one of the things. When you shoot at night in a place like New York, you have to go really late at night. And unless you want to get a whole bunch of cars and move them around, you're going to see a much quieter New York than you'd ever see in real life. Now, there was a great ad-lib from Danny that I cut out. He made a reference to Sal Magley, the barber, great New York pitcher. And we left it in for a long time and then decided that nobody would really get it. I was that Danny was a little upset that we didn't keep that in for him. These are stuntmen up there. Don't try this at home. Don't try it in New York either, actually. Of course, we added the dialogue later. It's not stuntmen talking. That's Bruce and Danny in a studio. Now, pretty soon, I'll show you another movie trick, which is we cut from New York City here to a stage in Rome, right there. We're no longer in New York. That reflection in the building is a translight. So this was shot quite a bit later, and see, you'd never know that.
Don't worry, bonehead, I'm wearing my girdle.
We're back here actually in a set in Rome, by the way. This is the inside of an auction house. That character there, Big Stan in the movie, is an actor named Bob Vasquez. A funny guy. He was actually a warden in the U.S. prison system or state prison system. I'm not sure what. And he got into movies because he was involved in the Stallone movie Lockup, I think it was called. And he had stories that were just bone-chilling.
173 Wongs in a phone book.
See, not only do we make a bad joke, but we punctuate it with Chinese music. How many times do you get to see that in a film? Once again, going back to the theme of the low-tech mode of entry, these guys are on skateboards. Thought it was kind of cute. This, once again, was a set in Rome. We didn't go into a building in New York to do this, although we did scout locations for this sort of thing. Generally speaking, you try to find real locations that work. In practice, it's easier sometimes to build a set and go shoot. You can get more done. Now, this whole idea of doing a burglary in which you play around with the video cameras, the surveillance cameras, Dan Waters came up with this idea, and the plan was for these two guys to switch the tapes to rewind them when the power goes down and play the tape back of 15 minutes before, so the security guards would think they were watching a live feed. I thought that was a really good, clever idea. And I've seen it in a movie since. I can't remember what movie it was. But whoever you are, you know that you stole from us. I want you to take responsibility.
Yeah, good plan, Junior.
We got about 5 minutes and change.
5:32.
Okay, so these guys are going to break into Swinging on a Star to time out their robbery. And you guys may be familiar with this song. It was actually recorded by Bing Crosby, or famously recorded by Bing Crosby. And one of the reasons we chose it is because we thought that the old Hope and Crosby road pictures had a flavor that was certainly different than this movie, but that could be played with here. So this was an attempt, as we do throughout this movie, to reflect on other elements of past pop culture and current pop culture in a way that is slightly knowing and maybe a little perverse.
You may
Michael Kamen, who composed the music for the movie and was involved from fairly early on in the process, did a nice arrangement for us. When we shot the scene, I wasn't really sure yet whether I wanted to have a full arrangement and do it like a musical number or do it more realistically and have these guys kind of singing to themselves. So we played around with it in the cutting room, and I thought it was much funnier and more unusual to have these robbers essentially do a musical number while they rip off an auction house. That's something that you see in movies even less often than Chinese music over bad jokes. And it was something that was, I think, pretty roundly criticized when the movie came out. Audiences just went, oh my God, what is going on here? We're watching an adventure movie or an action movie, and all of a sudden these guys are smiling and singing, which is kind of my response to every musical I've ever seen. And I thought it was a good thing to do in this context. Nowadays, if anybody's brave enough to tell me that they've seen this movie or liked it, they either tell me, I love the singing when they break in, or, how in the world could you have done that? What did you think you were doing? So I think it works. I think it's funny. You could be better than you are. And chances are you won't see these actors perform in a musical again. I got out of jail yesterday and I'm robbing an auction house. Now, these two guys here, just so you know, the one on the left was the publicist for the movie, Michael Klasteren. The one on the right is Scott Edo, who is Bruce's makeup artist. So if you think they're amateur-ish in their acting, I disagree with you. I think they're great. You could be swinging on a star. Let's take it home. You could be swinging on a star. So there's the Three Stooges style there. You get two guys, their heads get bonked together, and you play a woodblock. Obviously, we were trying to keep things moving in the movie and have fun with the stuff, but once again, it's more comedy than it is hard action. So something that I'll say over and over again was not really expected in this film when it came out, and probably got in the way of people's enjoyment. Here we are in New York. There are going to be two guys jumping soon.
Can I ask you a question? What? I'm not as fat as that guard, am I? Oh, no. You're a slender reed compared to that guard. Come on, Slim Jim.
Okay. These are two very brave stuntmen on descenders, which are cables that keep them from falling all the way to the ground. You can see the cable if you look closely. Now, you'll notice that they fell through an awning, and Bruce fell into a chair. Once again, when the movie came out, a lot of people said, this doesn't make any sense. Well, duh, that's the point. So we were kind of playing around with the conventions of action-adventure movies very deliberately, and I think all in good fun, and people either got it or they didn't. I love that moment because it makes no sense whatsoever. This actor is Donald Burton, who plays the part of Alfred the Butler. It's interesting, in the Steve D'Souza draft of the script, the character that Donald plays was written as a 7-foot-tall African Zulu warrior brandishing a spear or a knife. And I thought that was an interesting idea, and I actually met with Wilt Chamberlain at the time, one of the high points of my life. And when Dan Waters did a rewrite, we talked about it, and we decided we would have more fun playing off of the kindly Batman butler element. There's a bit of blood for all you blood fans. So we cast a conventional English butler and gave him a vicious Bond-esque retractable knife. I think Gates promised Hawker cut too. Those things are much harder to make work than they look like. I venture to say, if you wanted to go out on the streets in New York with a knife like that, and you weren't Laurence Olivier or Donald Burton, you'd have a really hard time, because they're bulky and they don't really work.
Ta-ta, Hudson Hawk.
Yo, 5 pills.
Did I miss anything?
Case tries to blackmail me. You ask me, did I miss...
We're back in New Jersey here. Once again, this running cappuccino joke, which we were sure nobody would get because they didn't know what a cappuccino was, is further reinforced by the fact that nobody knows that's a cappuccino machine. Because it's an old one.
You may want to get this looked at.
Geez, Gates was killed. So who do we send a thank you note to?
A butler did it. That was a cross between Alistair, Cook, and a Cuisinart. Took Mr. Ed, Humpty Dumptied it over Gates' head, and get this. He said it was made by Leonardo
da Vinci's forza. I consider it to be the prize of tonight's
auction. So, Danny Aiello had the hardest time saying the word sforza. And I don't blame him. It's a tough word to say. And honestly, I don't know whether there really was a Sforza horse created by Da Vinci, but Steve D'Souza says that there is. And we did take after take after take of Sforza. And if you go back and look, you'll see that we never actually have Danny on camera saying the word Sforza, because I think we had to record him in a recording studio to get it right.
Butler's forcing me to steal something, which now it appears I didn't steal after all. It's all too goddamn peculiar, Tommy. Let me ask you something.
What?
How much does a new tuxedo cost?
A fantastic example of Florentine bronze.
Now, in the long tradition in adventure movies of characters in tuxedos, we got Bruce into a nice tuxedo there. And without a tie, however. And we are, to a certain degree here, echoing a scene from North by Northwest, which takes place in an auction house. That's a pretty lame reference and a pretty obvious one, so I'm not going to dwell on it. Andy McDowell makes her first appearance here. I will talk about her presence in the movie. She's a wonderful actress and has enjoyed a great career and was doing very well at this time because she had been in Sex, Lies, and Videotape, which was released the year, maybe 2 years before this. And she had also done the movie Green Card and put in a great performance. She was not, however, the original actress cast in that role. We originally cast Isabella Rossellini, and which I thought would be great. I love her. I think she's a terrific actress. I had a couple of meetings with her. She was set to do the movie. And Hudson Hawk got delayed. Hudson Hawk was originally going to be shot right after Bruce finished the movie called Mortal Thoughts, I'm pretty sure. And what happened was Die Hard 2 got accelerated into production more quickly than expected, and Bruce and Joel Silver, the producer, went off to do Die Hard 2, and I sat around for a number of months prepping this film. During that time, we lost Isabella Rossellini because she had other commitments. Then we cast an actress named Marushka Detmers, who was a Dutch actress who lived in Paris, who was quite good, had only done European movies. And when she showed up to work, she had back problems, serious back pain, and she lasted about 3 days, and we finally decided that she just wasn't healthy enough to do it. And I'll get back to that later. But Andy McDowell didn't actually make it to our shoot until maybe a third of the way through. And she did a great job stepping in. It was a very difficult part.
Perfection. The Vatican extends its jealousy to the lucky bidder.
Thank you, Doctor. We'll begin the bidding at $20 million. To you, sir. 20.5.
Richard E. Grant, who plays Darwin Mayflower, is a terrific actor and a very funny character and makes a great compliment to Sandra Bernhard, who makes a great entrance. Both of these characters are clearly playing their parts in a way that's rather amped up and more driven by energy and comedy than by subtlety. There, that's a good example. I happen to think they're both really great, and we were going for something that was risky, and in letting the performances go that far over the edge, it was fun. It works sometimes. Sometimes it doesn't work, but they were great doing this. There you get to blow up an auctioneer. Another one of the fun things you can do when you make a movie. There was an actual dummy exploded. That wasn't the real auctioneer. So if you or your children are worried, we didn't kill any auctioneers in the making of this movie. That column is made of lightweight material, so it doesn't kill anybody, but it fell down nonetheless.
That was bold of you. You didn't have to do that.
It's nothing. Anybody would have done the same thing.
No, I mean, you didn't have to tackle me and rip my dress.
Oh.
Oh, I'm just kidding. Thanks for saving me, tough guy. Why was that car chasing you?
Because danger, Doc. Is my middle name. Oh!
You can see how hard a time we had slipping in "is my middle nut" before that horse hit him. And you'll also notice that that horse is a Pegasus. And what is TriStar? What is their logo? A Pegasus. Now, why would we have the studio logo hit Bruce Willis in the face? I don't know. You can answer that question. Okay. This was one of the last things we shot in Los Angeles. One of the only things in the movie shot in Los Angeles, besides the prison that I mentioned earlier. Oh. That's got to hurt. We were on a stage in Burbank, and this is the real Brooklyn Bridge, however. We did a big, big sequence on the Brooklyn Bridge here on a hospital gurney. In order to do this, we had to shut down the Brooklyn Bridge for about 5 nights, which made us incredibly popular in New York. In fact, wherever we went, people seemed to be aware of us, and they were so happy that they couldn't take the bridge back and forth to Manhattan. We were actually shot at by snipers from Brooklyn. I'm not kidding. That young lady there, who asked him if he was going to die, was the Playmate of the Year, but she was also a friend of the production and did a great job with that little line. Now, Bruce is out there on a motorized gurney. It was not safe to have a real gurney going loose over the bridge. We looked at the Jerry Lewis movie, The Disorderly Orderly, I think it is, has a famous gurney chase. And I tried to do as much as I could, just like the way Jerry does it. And this is what we got. This was, in fact, a very difficult scene to shoot, not just because we had to shut down the bridge. Oh, by the way, the toll plaza there, the few of you that live in New York who will see this probably will know that there is no toll plaza at the Brooklyn Bridge. I'm sorry. I take full responsibility. We talked about that for a long time, and we talked about changing it to another bridge. It's actually a toll plaza from one of the tunnels. I'll leave it up to you guys to guess which one. But and that Collisionville back there really was the name of the body shop. Sometimes irony presents itself in a neat and packaged form when you make a movie. Kit Kat, the character played by David Caruso, never speaks. You'll notice that he had tattooed on his hand the word frog. In fact, on his other hand, he has tattooed the word hate. And those of you who've seen, Robert Mitchum, you know, the Charles Laughton directed movie, you know, Night of the Hunter. He's got love and hate. Here we've got frog and hate. The CIA agents here all have candy bar names. Lorraine Toussaint was the woman who plays Almond Joy. Andrew Bernarski there plays Butterfinger. We had a lot of fun with these guys. They are the hench people of James Coburn, whose name in the movie is George Kaplan. And it doesn't take much of a film buff to hear the words George Kaplan and think of North by Northwest again. But that's the last North by Northwest reference in this movie.
Well, I know you.
The last time you saw me, I was bald with a beard and no mustache. And I had a different nose. So if you don't recognize me, I won't be offended.
This was the first night that we shot with James Coburn. He is a phenomenal actor. And obviously has a great career, great roles, Great Escape, Duck, You Sucker, the movies I mentioned before. He's played a number of terrific roles. And what I found, this was the first time for me as a director working with an actor with that experience at that level. And he never stopped astounding me throughout the shooting. He would do it in two takes. He'd do it in two takes to get it right. If he wanted something different, he'd give me something different, but he really, really knows how to do what he does extremely well, and was a pleasure to work with.
Maybe nobody told you. I
And he entertained us with stories all the time of working with great directors and working on all those odd and interesting movies he'd done over the years.
Good God, what's that?
Now, George, you don't expect me to fall for that old gag, do you?
Shucks, I guess not.
Now?
Yes, now.
Now, how could you not think that we're making a comedy here? This, by the way, I think, is our first actual shot in Rome. I'm not positive anymore. It's a long time ago. But we had to find an apartment in Rome that provided a view of something that was characteristically Roman. And when we looked around, and we saw some great apartments. I wanted to move there after scouting. We found one place that was right up against the Colosseum. So you'll see here we go from box to apartment. And we move across the room. To reveal the Colosseum. And it seems all very easy and nice, but I'm telling you, it is so much trouble to find these places and get permission to use them and make it work.
Welcome to Rome, sir.
By the way, getting locations in Rome is a story in itself. Movies have been made there since the beginning of movies, and they make great movies, and they have great locations. They have an interesting system of location payments. I don't think I should say any more about that, but I'll get into it later. I want to talk about this car. That is I can't remember for sure if it's a 55 or a 56 Chrysler Imperial or New Yorker. At any rate, it is the kind of limousine that was used in the Eisenhower era, and we stretched it. You notice we stretched it quite a bit. They didn't have stretched limousines like that. We had to find a couple of these things because we were going to subject it to some violence down the road and have it stretched by a limo company. And I told my production designer, Jackson Degovia, who did a terrific job on the movie, by the way. I'm going to mention here also this building was Mussolini's administrative offices in a district called EUR in Rome. And we designed the Mayflowers, the two characters here, all their stuff to be quite deliberately fascist in style. So all of you architecture buffs and fascism enthusiasts should be appreciating every moment of these scenes. Anyway, we stretched this limousine, and we had to find a couple of good examples of this car. And I remember going to someone's house in Los Angeles and talking to them, looking at their car and talking to them, and not being able to tell them that we were going to buy this car and hack it in half and stretch it and destroy it. And I felt so bad. You know, people do so many dishonest things when they make movies. I felt so bad about that because this guy loved that car.
God's sake, somebody chain this convict.
Listen, Hawkey, this might be hard to believe.
Now, that sound might be familiar to some of you as the Flint phone sound from Our Man Flint. I had to put it in somewhere. And we actually conceived those cuffs with a musical keyboard. Probably as an opportunity just to put that Flint sound in there. Richard E. Grant's slap of Donald Burton there, by the way, was entirely impromptu. And if you back it up and look at Donald's face, he did a great job of just sort of sticking with the scene, even though he was slapped rather rudely right across the face. Now, what that dog is doing to Bruce, well, I guess we can talk about that now because it's being done everywhere. But at the time, when it wasn't in the news every day that famous people were getting that kind of treatment, we had a lot of concern that this might be a little bit too racy. Just thought I'd mention that.
You'll have a guinea barkeep cellmate to keep you company. You're young.
These guys like slapping, don't they?
Shanking child molesters for a pack of smokes. But Tommy Fivetown will go in knowing the next time he gets out will be to attend his own funeral.
Now, I want to take the responsibility for some of this away from Sandra and Richard. They were encouraged to play these characters in a very arch fashion, and I salute their bravery and their commitment to do it. Honestly, I think that It's a tricky thing to play this kind of material that way, and a lot of people don't like it, and a lot of people do. And I look at it now and I go, wow, I can't believe that we actually did that. But we did, and it's part of the charm of this movie. I believe those photographs were taken by, oh, I'm not sure, by an L.A. photographer named Greg Gorman. But I know, I heard they had a lot of fun taking those pictures. Now, shooting in the Vatican is obviously something that isn't done. And we were able to drive our limousine past the Vatican without getting in trouble. Those two guys, by the way, Steve and Doug Martin, are old friends of mine. They're both filmmakers and very interesting people, and they agreed to come along to Rome to play the silent parts of Ig and Uk. They didn't realize they were committing 6 weeks of their lives because of the way our movie was scheduled. This, by the way, is this location is a villa outside of Rome called Caprarola, which is used for every Vatican shoot in every movie ever made. When we were scouting it, The Godfather 3 was there. So this location has a great deal of pedigree, and I'll bet none of you ever thought that it wasn't actually the Vatican because of that map room. There is a great map room at the Vatican. Now we're back in sets built in Cinecittà. This set was the first set that we worked on in Rome, and I remember when we got there that Joel Silver, the producer, brought in a Catholic priest to bless the set, which is by far the weirdest moment I've ever had in my movie-making career. He assembled the entire crew, Italian and American, around this part of the set here, and the priest blessed the set, and Joel talked about who he was and how much money his movies had made and what a great star Bruce was, and thanked the priest for blessing us and said this would help our production, and I don't know if it really helped, but it was a lot of fun. I talked earlier about Marushka Detmers and Andy McDowell and Isabella Rossellini. This scene was originally shot with Marushka Detmers. So in the future, some film historian may be able to dig up the footage. I thought Marushka was quite good, and she had to leave because of a back problem. And later on in the shoot, and this was my first exposure to this kind of tabloid journalism, later on in the shoot, it was printed all over Europe in the tabloids that Marushka had to leave because Demi Moore found out that Bruce was having an affair with her. And, you know, with all due respect to all those tabloid journalists, it was really weird to read that and realize it was entirely false and naive of me to think that these things didn't really happen. But when we were shooting later on, a photographer also took a photograph of Bruce and Andy McDowell kissing during a scene, and it was printed in the papers as an example that they were having an affair. So now that the Willis-Moore marriage is no longer intact, I have to say it had nothing to do with any of this. They were very happy.
Is that smoke bad for you?
This way.
Where are we going?
Through here.
That big chandelier, by the way, was designed by Jack DeGovia. Was a huge contraption that actually did what you just saw it do, which was collapse and encase the codex book. Now here, this is interesting. This location is a postal subway. The idea is that this is how the mail gets into the Vatican, because we all know the Vatican has their own post office, and we concocted the idea that somehow they would have a whole, you know, monks there working, sorting the mail, and little trains that come in from the rest of Italy and the rest of the world. In actual fact, this is a micro-gauge railway system that's a postal railway in the city of London. And our line producer, the producer who actually was responsible for the day-to-day workings of the movie, Michael Dryhurst, knew about this. And when he read the scene, he said, you know, there's a great postal subway in London, and I think we can get the location for a day or two and shoot there, which we did. We flew to London, I think, on a weekend and shot a very difficult, busy single day down there.
Father, it's obvious he's up to something.
Report upstairs at once.
Yes, sir.
See, a talking Jesus is something you also don't see in very many movies these days. I know it's a staple of old movie making, but here we're in a different location in Rome.
Did he mention the Mayflower?
I just thought this scene was beautifully lit by Dante Spinotti, who was the director of photography, who did this portion of the shoot.
Vatican has foiled the advances of pirates.
Rome has wonderful locations. They're absolutely amazing. You can go anywhere there and find something beautiful to point the camera at.
Must you flirt with him so effectively?
That's the only way.
As an agent of our organization, you are put in awkward situations. Just remember, Hudson Hawk is an evil, evil man.
I have to say that these expository scenes were really tough in this movie because we were trying to tell a story that didn't make a whole lot of sense, but it needed a narrative thread. And looking at it now, I go, every time we go into one of these scenes that tries to anchor the audience a little bit and orient them in terms of the story, it's a little dicey. But the actors did well with it. Here we are in Piazza Navona in Rome, another difficult location to shoot in. You can imagine what the Romans thought when they saw that car driving around. It's not a Fiat.
Oh, thank God. 212-555-1989.
If you dial 555-1989, you're going to get a studio in L.A. where they answer the phone every time you dial a 555 number and they'll tell you it's no longer in service.
Pick it up! Pick it up, Tommy! The black thing! On the desk! Come on, Tommy.
This violence all seems so tame by today's standards.
Kick your big flabby ass!
Hawk! Hawk! Hawk!
People talk about the difficulties of production. I know in the standard line in a director's commentary on a movie is how hard it is to keep the continuity of light and all that sort of stuff. Well, it's true, and this is a case where it was very difficult. We're shooting in the midday sun in Rome, very hot, very bright, you can see that, and trying to get things before the shadows went down below the buildings and trying to control the crowds. So a simple scene like this where you have a couple of people standing around and talking can consume tremendous amounts of time and energy and complication. It's the biggest frustration, I think, for a director shooting on location.
Oh, no. The timing is off. The schedule is not right. I'm under-equipped, and besides that, I got a date.
Grapple, biker's bottle, pocket fisherman, olive oil, 100 stamps. Geez, this is going to be some day. No Harvey's Bristol cream?
Snickers, make that list happen. Oh, and it's one thing to play hide-and-seek with a Mayflower's pathetic staff.
I would love this, that David Caruso is dressed as Bruce Willis here. His character, Kit Kat, was a complete and total wild card. He didn't speak. He would show up with no explanation, doing things that made no sense. I believe that David and Bruce pretty much improvised. They certainly improvised that. That was something they came up with. But Dan Waters, who wrote the Kit Kat character, had all sorts of great stuff for him, including these little cards.
Hey, Mr. Hawk, he got your stamps.
Good, Yogi.
Okay, here's that little postal railway. And, see, we make it all clear for you. Bruce was actually in that little train, inside a box, and he's really great about doing that sort of stuff. Really, really terrific in terms of getting into difficult situations. He doesn't do his own stunts per se, but he certainly is willing to do as much as the stunt coordinator will allow. Our second unit director and stunt coordinator on this film was Charlie Picerni, who was absolutely incredibly good with this stuff. and he'd worked with Bruce before, and I really think he did a great job. He did a lot of movies with Joel Silver at that time, and he was a great pro and knew what an actor could and shouldn't do. I can't remember if we had to enhance those beams in post-production, but it was a kind of a nice effect. For those of you who can't figure out what's going on here, I don't blame you. It's not that easy to tell. He's greasing the floor with olive oil and sliding two mirrors clamped together in front of laser beams, or electric eye laser beams, in order to reflect the electric eye back at its source and fool the machine into thinking that it hasn't been violated. I wouldn't try that at home because I don't think it would work. The two Italian actors here came up with the idea of spaghetti out of a thermos. I thought that was good local color. Always makes me laugh. I also love this sort of thing. They get two chemicals that, you know, when you put them together, they make a little reaction. I have no idea what that's supposed to be in real life, but it looks so good on screen. This actor, Antonio Iorio, I think his name is, I can't remember, ingratiated himself with me immediately by telling me he'd seen my movie, The Applegates, which nobody in the world has seen. So all you would-be actors out there should know that it works. See, he has a softball to go through the window and a grappling hook. Once again, the idea that he's a low-tech burglar who can pull off the most sophisticated job with the simplest of tools is something that I really think is funny and good here. Now, that is a translite, which we brought in to do a couple of shots. It's a huge ordeal to do this stuff. These things were shot on the back lot of Cinecittà. See, those of you who haven't seen Mr. Ed in Italian, you get the chance here. And that actor, by the way, I was told by our Roman casting director that he is the best look-alike for the Pope in Rome who can act. And I took his word for it. So this sequence was shot in the back lot at Cinecittà and out on the streets in Rome. Fairly, you know, these things which look so easy and are fairly straightforward get to be very complicated. I know it's stupid to hear a director say that, but it's really true. And I look at this, I'm just saying this because I look at it and go, oh yeah, we spent 3 hours setting up that shot. And we had to do all these little things to make it work. We were going to have Bruce land with the light between his legs, the lamppost between his legs, but we decided that was too silly, so instead we had him fall on top of a bus with chickens. And fall right into a chair, which is something that you may remember from earlier in the film. So we're quoting ourselves here at this point. I was never convinced about the feathers coming out of his mouth, but it is cute.
You look very nice. You really do. What?
I am the waiter, sir.
See, we were Americans in Rome making a movie, so to have the Americans say, what? And bring me a bottle of ketchup. That's what the Europeans think Americans are like. See, so we wanted to give them reason to believe that they were right. It actually was, it's an interesting thing about making a movie. As an American making a movie in Europe, you learn a lot about how Americans are perceived abroad, and you learn a lot about how crude and horrible you are as a person. Because they remind you. This movie did very well in Europe, by the way. Did I mention that?
Harry and in love.
Grazie, molto bene. Need the worst ketchup when I was in prison.
prison.
I was a warden.
How long were you in?
Let's just say I never saw E.T.
I never saw E.T. either.
Wow. You were just in
kidding.
The joint. Doing hard time.
I think that Andy McDowell did very well stepping into the middle of this movie and dealing with the dialogue, which Dan writes so well and is, as I mentioned before, tends to be rather arch in its humor. And we were constantly trying to figure out the right tone for her, and she really proved to be a very willing, you know, she was willing to experiment and play around, which was great. Bruce was also... I think, I don't want to speak for him, but I think he really liked Dan's dialogue a lot and liked to deliver it, and he's very good at that. He's very good at playing a certain kind of humor that that Dan Waters writes well and that Steve D'Souza writes well, because the two of them have slightly different sensibilities. I should mention, since Bruce here is talking about his character and the origin of his character and all that, that this Bruce conceived of this character at some point, I think before he did Moonlighting. And he always wanted to make a movie about Hudson Hawk, about this great cat burglar. And there were scripts written by the writing team of Reno and Osborne, which I actually never read. And then Steve D'Souza, who had written Die Hard 2, and I can't remember if he wrote Die Hard 1. I think he did. Steve D'Souza wrote a draft that was... very funny and very lively and very much a kind of fun action-adventure comedy. But it was a little bit, I felt it was a little too close to home and that it was too much like too many other movies and that people had seen enough of this stuff without being reflective on it, and that it would be fun to take the genre and turn it on its head and have things like Talking Jesuses and stuff like that. And so Dan Waters, who wrote Heathers and was a friend of mine, came in and worked on rewrites and ended up reworking a lot of stuff that D'Souza had written. And I think that it's interesting how it evolved. There was not a lot of improvisation on the set, but Bruce also had a lot to say about the scenes and about the way he played his character. And there was a lot of evolution and a lot of discussion. And when the movie came out, there was also a lot of press related to the so-called excesses of the movie and the development of the script and Bruce's involvement. And it was interesting to see that being discussed as the movie came out, because most of the discussion, I thought, had little to do with the actual movie itself and more to do with the rumors about what happened during the shooting. It's just an odd... I'm really only remarking on this because it's an odd thing that when you make a movie, it's a focused process in which you work on the work right in front of you. But there can be a public perception of that. And we didn't pay any attention to it while we were making the movie. But you're forced to pay attention to it when the movie's released. And that kind of talk contributes to the actual perception of the movie when it comes out. And in this case, since the movie was generally not well reviewed, although there were some people who liked it, and not a big box office success on its initial release, it was very difficult for us to filter out how much of the criticism of the movie was based on the movie itself or on the expectations of the movie compared to what it was, or on the expectations based on the rumors that happened during shooting. And did I mention, by the way, it was a big hit in Europe.
Tell me at the restaurant that Hawk had hit the Vatican tonight. My people will not be happy. I want to see Kaplan.
There's a beautiful castle in San Leo again. I mentioned earlier how difficult it was to get locations in Italy. To shoot at a castle like that, that's a national monument, you have to get approvals from the government and from all the various bureaucrats that that are responsible for this stuff. And by the way, this set here is in Hungary. So they walked from Italy to Hungary in a few short steps. Getting permission for locations was very complicated and sometimes very expensive and always very uncertain. And one of the difficulties we had in making this film was in order to get locations, you had to plan way in advance, sometimes months in advance, to get the proper permissions. And since we were making a movie and sometimes making changes in the script, There's David Caruso dressed as Andy McDowell, which I think is absolutely wonderful and great of David to do. And he just shows up very briefly. We were concerned that nobody would know it was him. Anyway, going back to getting locations there, when you make a movie, you make changes as you go sometimes, and in this case we did, some of which I'll explain because some are pertinent to the things that are going to be happening soon. And did you notice that that's not a real dog, that that's a dummy?
Hit me with your best shot.
We couldn't get permission to shoot in some of our locations because we didn't have enough lead time. But we still had to make the movie, and we had to design scenes around locations we could use, and we quite frequently had to go grease the palms of the locals in order to get the locations, which was annoying and expensive and, as I said, uncertain, and made it very difficult because quite often I wouldn't know 2 weeks in advance that I'd be able to shoot a scene in the location for which it was planned. And quite often at the last minute we'd show up and our location manager would say, well, we have the location, but there's a man here who's going to get into a lot of trouble if his superiors find out that you came in like this, so you're going to have to pay him a certain amount of money to make sure that that trouble is not too disturbing. And, you know, that's not my business as a director necessarily, but when a production is as expensive as this one is, everybody's concerned about keeping the costs down. And it becomes incredibly annoying to think that at any minute the rug might be pulled out from under you on a location.
Three crystals for the gold machine, the world economy will be ruined.
Aye, aye, aye.
Lord help us. But what of Tommy Five Tone?
See, don't you love to hear a priest say the words Tommy Five Tone?
But you must remember, sister, you have your vows to God as well as your mission to the world.
Yes, Your Eminence. Just say, God go with me.
God go with you, sister.
Ball! Ball!
I love Sandra's outfit there.
Jolly good.
I really regret putting in that spring sound when the tennis ball hits his forehead. I think that goes a little too far. This set, once again, was in Budapest. And we're shot towards the end of shooting. We did our final month or two in Budapest, where we had big sets built. What I wanted to say was that one of the reasons we were shooting in Budapest was the draft before the final draft had a huge sequence that took place in the Kremlin, and it was great actually. The final break-in in the movie was to be the break-in to a very unusual safe. I'm going to take a little time out from what I was talking about here to mention that in order to get a bullet in somebody's forehead, there are two ways that, at least in the old days, used to be done. One is you shoot a blood pea at someone through a pea shooter. You have like a little pea filled with blood, and it leaves a mark in the middle of their forehead. I've done that on movies before. In this case, the makeup man made little holes in their foreheads with makeup and made plugs that were pulled out with monofilament so that at the right time we pulled the plugs and little holes appeared. I know a lot of you guys spend a lot of time wondering how they make holes in people's bodies and stuff like that. I think you can tell here that we had a long shoot and things were getting very, very difficult.
Come to think of it, there is a part of your body that you won't be needing for your next job.
I always did want to sing like Frankie Valli.
Big boys don't cry.
Going back to the Kremlin, we had a break-in to a spinning safe, a safe that revolved. And the idea was you could only get into it when the parts were lined up the right way. And Dan Waters wrote a very elaborate, very odd, very funny, and virtually unshootable scene involving the break into this spinning safe. And I say unshootable only because it would have been very, very expensive to build the set. This location, as I said, was Mussolini's little Colosseum. That was a location that we had a very difficult time procuring. And in fact, some Italian bureaucrat got very rich. We were told that the Prime Minister of Italy had asked to remove certain barriers in front of the building, and he was told that they wouldn't go down. And I came to shoot there, and I said, I can't shoot this building with those barriers up. And they said, hey, we turned down the prime minister. This is going to cost you a lot of money. I don't know how much they paid. I don't know who they paid. That's all I'm going to say about this.
Alchemy is the business term of the 90s, my man. Minerva read about it in an airline magazine.
So we had a scene in the Kremlin. And I'll get back to it again later because I'll talk about which scene came in to replace it. But because of that, we arranged to shoot in Budapest and scouted locations there. Now, by the time the movie was actually made, we had had to change that scene for cost reasons, and we had committed to building sets in Budapest.
Fuck junk bonds! We've got the real deal. Money will always be paper, but gold will always be gold.
I wonder if in today's market, what he's saying about gold has any validity. But you know, this was a primitive time, late 1980s. They didn't have stock markets like they have now, computer trading.
Drown in the saliva of their own nervous breakdowns.
Sounds like a party.
Markets will crash. Financial empires will crumble.
Except yours.
In 1992, baby, the European superpowers are coming together for one business superpower. And that's one party we're going to love.
See how prophetic her words were about 1992? I have no idea what happened in 1992.
On display for 3 days only at the Louvre in Paris.
As opposed to the Louvre in Wisconsin?
Shut up. You're going to make me lose my place. You're going to have to go in at night. The security will be overwhelming.
12 guards...
Ho. Okay, time out. I choose not to accept the assignment, Mr. Phelps. Put me in jail. Put me in jail.
I'm sure you guys all caught the Mr. Phelps reference, which is Mission Impossible. This was before they made a movie of Mission Impossible, so we were ahead of our time here.
I'll torture you so slowly, you'll think it's a career.
I always love that line. I'll torture you so slowly. I will torture you so slowly, you'll think it's a career. I thought that was describing my experience directing this movie at that time. Come to think of it, that kind of became my career. Don't ask me to explain the significance of the two naked men arm wrestling behind Danny, but when you make a movie with strong male bonds, you have to echo that thematically in the set dressing. By the way, I think Jack Dugovia did a great job. I mentioned before that we chose fascist architecture to combine with other elements of Renaissance Italian architecture. There was a very deliberate kind of postmodern sensibility in the design in this movie. We looked at a lot of the architecture of the time that was called postmodernism and used elements from the past combined in a comic and ironic way with elements of the present-day architecture. And to a certain degree, we were trying to echo that architectural style in the storytelling style of this movie. I don't think that worked because I don't think anybody recognized it or cared to recognize it or even cared if they did recognize it when they saw the film. But it's interesting to me looking back on it that that's, you know, that was one of the things that we talked about and one of the things that we tried to put in. Those were a couple of dummies thrown off.
Freedom
for
a lousy job.
Now, this sequence here was shot on the steps of this building, and Bruce injured his face in a close-up shot in which he actually was pushed too close to the camera and cut his, I think it was the edge of his forehead or his nose, on the edge of the camera, which was a scary thing. We had to shut down for a couple days. He ended up being okay. You don't see it. It's covered with makeup. But that was the only thing on this movie that I remember that was ended up being kind of dangerous. Besides the release of the movie, which was dangerous to all of us.
Plan B.
So once again, staples of action-adventure movies, Bond kind of films and whatnot are being played with in this film. And it was something that I always found kind of charming about the approach we took. The Vatican arms on the back of a truck. This, by the way, this scene here in the forum, is where the paparazzo took a picture of Bruce and Andy McDowell kissing, which ended up in the papers all over the place. Shameless what these people do. Everybody free.
Catch it. You can't beat Heinz 57.
5-2.
What?
You fucked my freedom for a lousy job?
I said you don't understand.
And you fucked the cafeteria. You better
sorry.
Be glad I don't hit women. Assuming you are a woman, because from now on I ain't taking nothing for granted.
Hey, look,
cousin,
Andy,
I'm sorry.
I honestly thought we could make this job work for us. Anna made me realize what a stupid pawn I was.
What more?
Hey, man, I love you.
Oh. Well, what's this?
Where did you get that?
The Da Vinci Castle. You know, the place where you gave the bad guys the codex.
That's from the gold machine.
This was another case where doing the expositional dialogue was extremely difficult for everybody. I apologize to those of you watching the movie. It's tough to have to listen to this. Now, actually, this is fine. This is the kind of thing that once we set out to make this film that had such a convoluted and quite often not strictly logical plot, we kept finding ourselves going, well, we're going to need to explain things here so that people aren't completely lost. I remember in that particular scene, I'm not sure which line it was, that poor Andy McDowell had such a mouthful to have to say that she was practically in tears. And we took breaks, we tried it over and over again, we rewrote, we did everything. I really don't blame her, because what she was being asked to say was impossible. And finally we ended up with something that worked okay.
Where to?
I told you, quit worrying about it, man.
Oh, I'm not worried. All right? I'm just being cautious.
Okay, guys. On that note, it's time for bed.
I couldn't agree more. Okay?
Tommy, you're going to sleep here.
Where are you going to sleep?
I'm trying to think of something interesting to talk about here, but you know what?
Good night.
I'll get you some cheese.
I can't think of any juicy stories. I love the set.
It's a very special night.
It was.
I'm going to talk about Bruce's earrings that you saw there. On the first day of shooting, after we, you know, we'd do makeup tests and we'd do wardrobe and all that, Bruce came in and said he wanted to have, you know, 5 or 6 earrings in his ear. And I thought that was a great idea. And those of you who are fans of that David Kelly legal show, The Practice, are probably also fans of many earrings. This is the kind of stuff that really drives everybody nuts making movies, because when Bruce said he wanted to wear 4 earrings in his ear, it became a big discussion. Joel Silver, the producer, I don't know, do you want to do that? People are going to think it's weird. Is that right for you? Does it look masculine enough? Then we have to make sure that the studio won't get upset when they see that their star has these earrings. It's really a pain sometimes. And this actually was a case where there was not a big problem about it. There was just a discussion, which I remember. I love this too, speaking of ears. Oh. That was half our special effects budget right there.
Morning. The license plates on the police van had a Vatican prefix. I'm losing respect for you guys. You were that close to getting away with this crap.
Painful for me to watch this scene only because it was painful to shoot it only because it had so many people sitting around in a room. And this is another one of those common director complaints, but when you have a long scene with 5 or 6 or more actors in a small room, you end up having to shoot it over and over and over again and shoot it from every different angle, and it ends up being very time consuming and makes everybody very cranky. And here, once again, the kind of humor that's in this scene where they've been paralyzed from the neck down by curare darts and start screaming and yelling. Some people like it. Some people think that this is where the movie goes too far. But did I mention this was a big hit in Europe, this movie?
The Louvre? The Louvre? Hawk is yesterday's news. Or should I say, this morning's.
I admit we displayed a lack of nuance. Didn't wear black, didn't sing swinging on a...
Don Harvey, who plays Snickers. I love that outfit he has on. He gets a good end coming up soon. He's a good actor who usually plays, you know, kind of scary, unpleasant characters, which I guess is how I cast him here too, but the chemistry between the various candy bars was good, and they were a pleasure to work with. And it was funny to watch how, during the shooting, they would take their cues from Coburn, who was a great leader, and would kind of rally their spirits together, because these guys, just one of the practical elements of filmmaking, they all spent many weeks in Rome and in Budapest waiting around while other scenes were being shot. And because we were in Europe, they couldn't fly home for the weekend or for the week. And so these poor actors were forced to spend a lot of time hanging out in boring places like Rome and Budapest, not knowing what to do. But in their defense, it's very tedious sometimes to wait and not know where they're going to shoot day to day.
Shoot!
I read your dossier, sister.
Pull the trigger!
I never liked that she falls right next to the other two guys. I always thought that was really fake. And you know, when you do scenes where people are paralyzed from the neck down by curare darts, you don't want them to be fake.
Those better be tears you're crying, Tommy.
They are.
Does that mean I don't love you?
Oh, no. You love me. It's your job. You probably love Butterfingers over there.
Oh, yeah? In a weird sort of Catholic way?
I always got a kick out of this stuff. Dan Waters is Catholic and is a very religious man, and had I always thought that he was walking a very odd line by writing a character who was a nun and a spy and who had a somewhat romantic involvement with our main character, who's a criminal. And I used to ask Dan how he felt about that, and he never really gave me an answer that satisfied me, so I can't answer that mystery. But there's a lot going on under the surface in these scenes because of that.
The good news is you'll be completely unparalyzed in about 2 minutes.
Bad news is that leaves only 5 seconds to defuse the bomb.
Bombs?
I'm so glad it had the...
Now, that big scene in the Kremlin had elements of this. It was in that scene that Snickers found himself with one of these bombs on his head. I think you're going to watch him blow up in a second here.
This is what I get for darting a nun!
This fucking thing off my head!
Tommy, look at Snickers.
He's about to have a bad migraine.
Maybe it was a dud.
So I regret being so insensitive about a character who's about to be blown up. I apologize to all of you. Now here once again, we're in Budapest. You can see the elements of fascist architecture and art. Not to mention Sandra's wonderful dress and hat. Marilyn Vance Straker did the costumes for the movie. She did a terrific job, I think, and very inventive, very funny stuff.
If you could do us the honor and decipher how the code works, we would be eternally grateful.
What does the color blue taste like?
Here's where Annie McDowell really shines in this scene. It's absolutely terrific what she does. And this is what I was saying before about to step in the middle of the movie and do dolphin sounds. And to have to do this with actors like Richard and Sandra is a sign of great courage and also great ability.
If you want to save Anna, you got to find a castle first.
Count of three. Why not just go now?
Okay.
What?
Who are you, Bob Hope for Texaco?
What the hell are you talking about?
We have some more continuity things coming up here that it goes from day to night very quickly. And once again, we're just playing around, trying to fool around a little bit with the conventions of filmmaking. I remember when I was in film school, a teacher had shown us a film, which I think was Johnny Guitar, and talked about all the ways in which it broke the conventions of storytelling. And I remember raising my hand saying, you know, they just made a mistake. They didn't know how to do it right. They didn't have the money. why are you guys talking about this as if it was intentional? And here I am, explaining to you that these things were intentional.
Hey! A lifetime of service that's come to this.
I think what he really meant was a lifetime of acting, and it's come to this.
Come on, you bitch!
I'm not a very good damsel in a dress, am I?
You must pay the rent!
But I can't pay the rent!
Yo, Flipper. A damsel in distress implies that there is some well-hung Dudley Do-Right galloping up to save you. It ain't gonna happen. Hudson Hawk go boom, boom. He dead.
I sometimes wonder what effect scenes like that have on the audience. And seriously, that you know, these scenes are very arch in their humor, and they cross a line. They cross it over and over again. And for some people, that's what makes the movie so special and makes it amusing and makes it fun. And for others, that explains why it was a big hit in Europe.
Did you set the timer on that thing?
No.
Well, from now on, please set the timer.
Come on, Butterfinger. Get gas. You guard the Mayflowers with your life.
There we have David Caruso doing yet another great little turn as Kit Kat. See, this, by the way, is what, to me, makes the movie work and makes it interesting, is that when you have characters like this, all his little cards that he speaks with come falling out. Where were they? You know, how does that happen? How did he happen to have one that says, I always liked you? This stuff is good. I think David did well with that, with the absurdity of the humor. Although there was a point where he was supposed to explain, it was supposed to be explained why he didn't speak, and we built a prosthetic for his mouth that had no tongue. And I think the scripted line was, Cat got your tongue, and he opens his mouth, and you see there's no tongue. And for some reason, David just didn't feel comfortable opening his mouth and showing that prosthetic with no tongue, and I couldn't get him to do it well enough. And I really regret not doing an extra take or two to make that work. Anyway, so we're back in the land of musical comedy at a very unlikely spot, at a spot in a movie when usually things get tense and get more serious. And once again, if you're with the movie at this point, that's all fine and good. And if you're not, you're going, how could they possibly break things to do this sort of thing at this point?
I'll take the front nine, you take the back nine, and we'll meet back at the clubhouse.
Hey, Tommy.
Yeah.
Looking good, my man.
Thanks.
Hey. How you doing?
Three, two, one.
Go in, read the Mayflowers on the current situation.
You got it, Coach.
Through all kinds of weather, what if the sky should fall? Just as long as we're together, it doesn't matter at all.
Now that is Danny singing, but obviously he's lip-syncing to his own singing, so those of you who think that we actually had an orchestra out there, you're wrong.
Side. I'll take that.
I always thought Sandra was very convincing there.
Hey, Coach. Looks bad. I think those Mayflowers set us up.
This whole sequence, once again, I'm going to keep going back to this, was taken from the Kremlin break-in. And we telescoped a number of elements of the Kremlin sequence and put them in this scene and that earlier scene in the apartment. It's interesting how scripts evolve and how you find these changes were made fairly late in the game, which, as I said, caused complications in the shoot because you can't really wing it as well in the locations we were shooting in. But this kind of stuff does happen on movies, at least some movies, and you sometimes are out there without a net, thinking that you can solve a problem in the script or solve a budgetary problem by rewriting scripts. It happens far more than people realize, and it's one of the challenges of making a film, especially one that's as complicated and that took so long to shoot as this, because you don't just go in when you shoot a scene with a fight or with any special effects. You don't just go in and wing it. You can't. You have to set this up. You have to plan it out. So I just remember working very, very many hours around this time, trying to make sure that all the elements in the earlier drafted scenes were still coming into place in the right way, and that we had all the production elements lined up to do the scenes right.
One, two,
not to mention, this was shot in Italy. All the exteriors were shot in Italy a good 6 weeks or so before the interiors were shot in Hungary. You may detect a little bit of Three Stooges kind of humor in here. That was something that Bruce was especially into. You'll see here... Well, maybe you won't. Let's see. See that photograph pasted to James Coburn's head? Now, you have to have a very discerning eye to see that. That's a photograph of a monkey. And that was a character named Little Eddie that was written into the script and cut out of the rest of the movie. Little Eddie was a monkey that was Hudson Hawk's pet monkey. His favorite, you know, he was in love with this pet monkey. It accompanied him everywhere and presumably had something to do with helped him out as his accomplice on robberies and on burglaries. There, you can see that photograph. The idea was, the backstory was, that James Coburn's character, George Kaplan, had arranged... Oh, boy, that guy in L.A. who sold me that car, he's not happy. I hope he doesn't know. Anyway, Little Eddie was Hudson Hawk's sidekick, and George Kaplan betrayed Hudson Hawk in the past, this is the backstory, and killed Little Eddie. So what we had was, in this fight, Bruce pulled a picture of Little Eddie out of his pocket, licked it, slapped it on Coburn's forehead, and said, "This one's for Little Eddie, mother," etc., and then threw him off the building. And we shot it that way. And in the final cut of the movie, it was just decided that there wasn't room for Little Eddie, and there wasn't room to break the story early on to talk about Little Eddie and fill in the backstory and have it all make sense. But we shot all those things of Coburn landing on the car with a photograph of a monkey on his forehead. And I'll bet none of you noticed that before I pointed it out. At least I hope not. But it's funny how when you cut a movie and you take things out, there are residual elements that you can't do anything about. And I kind of like that Little Eddie still is in the movie, unexplained until now.
Don't do it, Hudson.
Relax.
Now I'm going to come back to this gold machine set here. You may remember it showed up in the beginning of the movie as Leonardo's workshop. We had to rebuild the set around it a bit, around the machine. The machine was designed by Jack DeGovia, production designer, and I believe built under Jack's supervision and possibly, I hope I have the names right, Derek Meddings was the man in charge of physical effects, of production special effects, during the shoot. And Derek was an Englishman who had done a lot of Bond films. He was terrific with this stuff. He either himself or he got us in touch with people who built the gold machine in England. And it was constructed in England, about 100 miles outside of London, made to work, and then packed up in boxes and sent to Budapest and reconstructed on a stage in Budapest. And then dressed for Leonardo's time and then dressed for the modern day. And it was a really elaborate and very interesting piece of machinery that did work. And honestly, I can't remember it giving us any problems when we were shooting. But a lot of work went into it. And you'll see we ended up making a mess of it.
If Da Vinci was alive today, he'd be eating microwave sushi naked in the back of a Cadillac with the both of us.
That's one of my favorite lines in the movie. Because microwave sushi, of course, makes no sense whatsoever. Dan Waters wrote this speech, and Dan wrote a terrific kind of really over-the-top, overblown Donald Trump on acid kind of speech for Richard to say here. And it was... He did the whole thing. I ended up cutting a couple of lines out of it in the final edit because it went on a little long, and I still kind of regret that. It's one of those things, you know, you want to shape a scene and not go too far, as if the concept of not going too far has any application here whatsoever. But in the last minute of the editing, I decided that he could lose a few words. There was a reference to Saddam Hussein, who was in the news at the time, that's some nice ILM special effects. You don't see that in every movie.
Let me ask you something.
What?
What would happen if I didn't put that crystal together exactly right?
What do you mean?
Well, let's just say, for example, I left out this little piece of mirror here. Would that be bad?
Real bad.
And as a native of the state of California, Eureka in reference to finding gold is absolutely wonderful. There she is, covered in gold. I have to say that Richard and Sandra were both quite capable of playing anger, confusion, horror at this point, because they've been stuck in Budapest for many weeks. And you should read Richard Grant's book. It's called The Film Diaries of Richard Grant. Very funny. Discussion of what it was like to make this movie, and he says a lot of stuff that I really can't say right here. But if you want some more details, read his stuff. It's funny.
Definitely your turn.
All right. Still over here and try to stay out of the way, all right?
Hudson.
What? See, I don't know how Dan could have written a scene where a nun kisses a superhero. It just seems wrong to me. I always wondered whether a belt buckle would really, in any universe, stop a bullet.
Attending that hat convention in July.
See, now it's a staple of these action movies that the hero comes up with some clever line after doing violence to the bad guy. And believe me, you won't be attending that hat convention was not the only line we had for that spot. The idea was actually to be making fun of these things a bit. I do love this moment. Something About Mary was not the first movie that had a dog catapult out a window. And you know, if they would just acknowledge that they saw this, they would be very, very brave. Now this, that is a model, by the way, just so you know, that's a model. That meaning the castle that exploded. We didn't really explode a castle in Italy. These shots here of them flying in the Da Vinci flying machine were shot against a blue screen. Nowadays they use a green screen, but this was in the old days. They're suspended in front of a screen, and background is added later. These shots are of a model. Here, in those shots, we suspended Bruce and Andy in a full-size glider off a crane and swung them down towards the ground. Sounds easy, but it's not. It's really not. And you know all the stories about getting shots with the sun going down and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, we waited a long time. We had to make sure it was all right. And if we blew it, too bad. We got one shot.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
Will you play Nintendo with me?
I can't think of anybody I'd rather play Nintendo.
The Nintendo line of the story was much more present in earlier drafts of the script, where Hudson Hawk kept talking about this thing called Nintendo that was invented while he was in jail. And, you know, we have two characters named the Mario Brothers, whatnot. And kind of like Little Eddie, it didn't really end up staying in fully fleshed out. But we thought it was all right to leave it in there at the end anyway.
Can I buy you a cappuccino?
Yes. Can I give you a kiss?
Yeah. I just wish Tommy were here.
No way.
That's not very nice.
No way! Yes way!
That's a bad time.
Did I miss anything?
Did you miss anything? You're supposed to be all crashed up at the bottom of the hill.
Airbags, can you fucking believe it?
You're supposed to be blown up into fiery chunks of flesh.
Sprinkler system set up in the back. Can you fucking believe it?
Now, we all know that in these movies, people defy death every which way, and nobody seems to shrug about it. We thought it might be funny to come out and just do a really bogus... take on that.
With the world saved and the secrets of Da Vinci protected, Eddie finally got his call.
So we're back to William Conrad for the end and our end credits. Thank you for all being so patient and listening. This movie was we shot for over 100 days under very difficult circumstances, and to a certain degree, we're pretty brutally punished when the movie came out, but probably at this point, when nobody really cares anymore how much was spent or how well Bruce Willis and Joel Silver were doing in their careers at the time and whether movies like this were signs of excess and needed to be brought down, I'm hoping that people can look at it and see where the humor came from and also see that we were actually ironically commenting on a lot of the things of which we were being accused. And at the time, there were things that we were satirizing pretty directly, which we were accused of abusing. And maybe that's right. Maybe we were trying to have it both ways, and when you do that, you're running a pretty ugly risk. But I hope that in retrospect, people can look at the film and enjoy it as it was intended to be enjoyed. Thank you very much.
Nickel in his pocket, time on both his hands, little Eddie Hawkins lost in Candyland. 10 years in the slammer, Eddie's done his time. On the street, ain't it sweet to pull the perfect crime? Everybody knows when the cold wind blows, the Hudson Hawk again. Let it rain, let it snow, let the north wind blow, it's the Hudson Hawk, my friend. You better watch out, better watch out what you do. The Hudson Hawk's with you. Listen up, all you sinners. This ain't no time to hesitate. When bad news gets around, someone's going down, and everybody better get their story straight. The Hudson Hawk's with you. Hudson Hawk's with you. Down on 49th and 10th, to Hudson Hawk again. Better put them out. Hudson Hawk, my friend. The Hudson Hawk's with you. When a cold wind blows, if it rains, if it snows,
hog again.